Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For generations of teenagers, Dick Clark was the slightly square guy who introduced the biggest names in pop.
Hottest dance sensation in the last 4 years, a thing called the Twist. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Chubby Checker.
Ladies and gentlemen, here are the Beach Boys.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Madonna.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is Prince.
I'm John Schaefer, and ladies and gentlemen, this is Soundcheck. Today, how Dick Clark shaped music, TV, race relations, and more in America. We'll open the phones to find out how Dick Clark influenced what you listened to as a teen. Later, the music of your youth sticks with you forever, right? Well, it turns out that it might be therapeutic. We'll talk with a social worker who uses old favorites to treat elderly patients with dementia, as seen in a YouTube clip that's been viewed more than 5 million times. All of that on Soundcheck after the news.
We're going hopping today, where things are popping. The Philadelphia way, we're gonna drop it on all the music they play on the bandstand.
Saying goodbye to America's oldest teenager. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, we remember TV personality and music industry giant Dick Clark and ask for your memories. Plus, we dig a bit deeper into music and memory and hear about a startling new treatment for patients with dementia. But we begin with Dick Clark, who died yesterday at the age of 82. From 1956 to 1989, Dick Clark hosted American Bandstand, the song and dance party that made a lasting impact on pop music and music on TV. A wide variety of artists appeared on American Bandstand, teen idols like David Cassidy, the Jackson 5, the Doors, Blondie, and joining us to look back at the pop icon who was Dick Clark is Max Robbins of the Paley Center for Media. Max, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here, John. Thanks.
He was called America's oldest teenager. I mean, he kept his youthful appearance well into his 70s, but there was another reason we called him that, right?
There was indeed. I mean, he really wanted to stay vital. That was good for business. And I think sometimes what gets lost is how shrewd a businessman he was. Now, we might have benefited from that culturally in that he had a good set of ears. He knew what, you know, he knew a hit, and he knew that he was putting Elvis Presley on or a lot of black groups like the Coasters or Chubby Checker, not because he was trying to make a statement about her. He just thought it was good for business, and he did extremely well. Mm-hmm. So he knew, being that perpetual teenager, keeping his thumb on the pulse of what was happening in pop music was going to help make him a very wealthy man.
And the funny thing is that, you know, he came across as somebody who was not personally hip. You know, he wasn't really, he was kind of slightly square, you know, and yet kids, you know, several generations of teenagers sort of followed him, it seems, pretty religiously.
They did, and I think that has to do with he was kind of a gateway. He was giving approval to all this music, and if, you know, you were a kid, you were a pop fan, this was going to be you trusted him, mm-hmm. that this was going to be the place you got that first glimpse of who the next big pop actor, singer was going to be.
It's all very well and good to have the kids trust you. I think his big thing was he got mom and dad to say, oh, that's what's happening. All right, you can watch that.
That's an excellent point. If they came in the room and whoever it was, whether it was Elvis Presley, whether it was Madonna or Prince, oh, well, it's that nice-looking young man who put them on TV, and he's so polite, they won't send you to a life of, you know, drug, sex, and rock and roll.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, the image that he projected certainly was aimed maybe at a generation older than his target demographic.
I think that's true, and I think that helped him to be the bridge from that, whatever the cutting-edge thing was in pop culture, to that commercial world.
Mm-hmm. Now, who wasn't on American Bandstand? Did he get everybody?
Just about. I think everybody was on American Bandstand. I believe even the Beatles were, the Rolling Stones were. I mean, pretty much everybody. I think if I'm correct, I think his first national American Bandstand show, of course it started locally in Philadelphia, was Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm. And
young Elvis Presley.
Yeah. Now, once the technology arrived to enable bands to lip sync, that's mostly what happened, it seems.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people who were not fans because there was something very programmed about the show, if you will. You didn't have that spontaneity of live. And of course, in a lot of ways, that really, really played into a lot of the pop ethos, where these groups were manufactured groups, where they didn't play. A lot of the groups we thought played their own instruments didn't. So the whole lip-syncing aspect of it fit well into what was going on in the business part of it.
You know, you'd see the Beach Boys on American Bandstand, and there'd be the five of them, no band, and yet somehow you're hearing the full orchestral sound of the Beach Boys. These are some of the sounds of American Bandstand, hosted by the late Dick Clark. He died yesterday at the age of 82 from a heart attack, and a little stroll down a musical memory lane.
Country all over the place. Hottest dance sensation in the last 4 years, a thing called the Twist. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Chubby Checker.
The gentlemen have released a brand new record. This is one side thereof. It's called Don't Worry, Baby. Ladies and gentlemen, here are the Beach Boys.
This is the Iron Butterfly.
This is Madonna.
Madonna from 1984, going all the way back to Chubby Checker and the Twist from 1962, all of it from American Bandstand, Dick Clark's program from 1956 to 1989. We're remembering Dick Clark today with J. Max Robbins. He's Vice President and Executive Director of Industry Programs at the Paley Center for Media, the old Museum of TV and Radio. And, you know, starting that little montage with the Twist reminds me that it wasn't just music. This show taught America to dance.
It did indeed. I mean, whatever the big new dance craze was, you were going to see it on American Idol. And I mean, American Bandstand. I'm sorry, but
a little Freudian slip
there.
Yeah.
Well, I think maybe if you have no Dick Clark, there is no American Idol. I mean,
right.
and the fact is that you did. I think that's a lot. That was a lot of the attraction of the show. Television's an intimate medium. Dick Clark put kids in that audience dancing, teens in that audience who looked like who he wanted his audience to be, and you could identify. There was a connection. I think that had a lot to do with the longevity of the show. And you pick out couples you'd see week in and week out. It was also, after not too long, a audience dancing that was that looked a lot like America, that was racially mixed.
Now, he actually, in a seminar at the Paley Center back in 2003, talked a little bit about this, about integration on the show American Bandstand.
We were never told to keep the show segregated. That was just what was done. We were never told to integrate it. We decided we'd better do this, and it happened. And slowly the population of blacks increased. By the time we got to L.A., it was blacks, browns, yellow, and every race in the world, and nothing ever happened. It was an extraordinary experience. There are no battles, no stabbings, no bloody battles after the show. It just happened. And millions of people watched it. And it was a wonderful experience. And probably one of the better things that came out of the show.
The late Dick Clark recorded at the Paley Center in 2003 talking about, integrating the audience the on-screen audience of American Bandstand to reflect the audience that would actually end up watching. Huge cultural iconic show for more than 3 decades. Soundcheck listeners, did you watch American Bandstand? If so, what did it mean to you? Or did you watch Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve to ring in the new year each year? Give us your memories, your thoughts about the late Dick Clark. You can comment online at WNYC.org/soundcheck or give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692 or WNYC.org/soundcheck. Max, the idea of, you know, kind of doing the right thing just because it made business sense, because it made programming sense, it's still the right thing.
Of course, it is the right thing to do. Dick Clark never considered himself a crusader or political in any way. If he was putting on all acts from every demo racial group you could imagine, it was because it was good for business.
Mm-hmm.
He was first and foremost a businessman, John.
And that got him into a little bit of trouble.
It did indeed. He had some back with the whole Paola scandals. This is back like the late 50s, early 60s. I mean, it was standard operating procedure where people got paid. They got paid well to play records and whatnot, and Dick Clark had an amazing amount of clout. It came out that there were some things that were pretty shady. It turned out he didn't, quote, break any law.
Right.
Ethically, you can call into question what he did, but that was what the one really big blemish in a career that given its longevity and the empire he created, it's pretty amazing in the business he was involved in, the music and entertainment business, that's the only blemish.
Right. And in terms of, I mean, you made that interesting mistake before saying American Idol instead of American Bandstand. And of course, as you say, you know, there may not have been an American Idol without American Bandstand. But from Dick Clark, it's not such a big leap to Soul Train, which followed in his footsteps. To Ryan Seacrest, who has co-hosted with him the
well,
last
Ryan Seacrest says Dick Clark is his role model, is who he was his hero.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real friendship and a real business arrangement that developed between the two. I mean, Dick Clark passed the mantle off to Ryan Seacrest.
Not entirely, though, because even post-stroke, when he couldn't really speak clearly, he still would come out on New Year's Eve with Ryan Seacrest and continue to host. Now, do you see that as striking a blow for, you know, disabled Americans, or is that just a sign of ego and wanting to be in front of the cameras?
I think it got to the core of who Dick Clark was. He always wanted to be vital. Of course, an institution like ours, the Paley Center, we're the Museum of Television and Radio, you always want to do the retrospective. You always want to do you have the gala honoring somebody who's a great from the industry.
Lifetime achievement.
Lifetime. Dick Clark never wanted any of that. He wanted to be vital. He wanted to be of the moment.
So did you guys ask him?
Oh, yeah. He was asked many times, declined. And even that clip you played, It was when he had a terrific TV show that was on NBC called American Dreams that was about the whole period around the Vietnam War, and he was executive producer on Made in Philadelphia with Bandstand as kind of a almost like a character in it. That was why he did that talk with us. And one of the rare times he really talked frankly about some of the social issues that his work and with Bandstand he was really involved with.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking about the late Dick Clark. He passed away yesterday. He was 82, hosted American Bandstand from 1956 to 1989. There was much more to his media empire right up to the annual New Year's Eve shows. We're speaking with Max Robbins of the Paley Center. We're going to take a break in just a minute, but first, let's get a call or two on the air. Jim is with us from Mamaroneck. Hi, Jim.
How you doing?
All right. You got a Dick Clark memory?
I have a pretty good memory. I was a junior in high school in 1956 in Lansdowne Olden High School outside of Philadelphia. We would watch that show. It came on right after school was out almost. And so we'd put on our sport jackets and go down there, which is where the hockey team played. I think that's where the set was, and wait, try and get into the show. Well, they had a whole bunch of regulars that would drive up in limos, South Philly guys and girls, and we would try and get in line. Never got into the show once, but we watched it like crazy.
So you mean the kids in the audience were regulars?
Yeah, yeah. There was a bunch of regulars who, in fact, couple got married. There are long stories about the regulars from the show that somebody could tell you about. I can't remember their names, Justine and Donnie or something like that. But they were really serious stars in their neighborhoods.
And of course, Jim is going back to the early days when the show was still done in Philadelphia. It would then move to California,
to Los Angeles, and mm-hmm. became a real national phenomenon.
In 1970, Dick Clark welcomed the Jackson 5 to American Bandstand. Oh. 1970, American Bandstand, the Jackson 5 doing I Want You Back. And in a moment, we'll continue to take your calls and comments about the legendary television host and producer, Dick Clark, who died yesterday at 82. And then later, the impact of music on those suffering from dementia is the subject of a new documentary and a viral YouTube clip. We'll learn more coming up later on Soundcheck.
What's the name of the next song?
Why You Want to Treat Me So Bad.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Prince.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now on the late Dick Clark, pop culture icon, longtime host of American Bandstand. He died yesterday at the age of 82. With me in the studio is Max Robbins of the Paley Center for Media, and in the background, a very young Prince appearing on the Bandstand in 1980 when he was just 19 years old. It wasn't just the music and the dancing, Max. It was also, I mean, the caller a moment ago was talking about the regulars. People would regularly get pulled out of the audience. He would sit among them, he'd talk to them, and people would be regularly asked to rate the hits.
Right. It's got a good beat and I can dance to it. That's why I like it.
The famous catchphrase. A little bit of the history of American Bandstand.
I've heard jokes about American Bandstand's Rate a Record segment. I can't go to an airport. I can't walk through a shopping mall without somebody yelling, "Hey, Dick, it's got a great beat. It's easy to dance to. I'll give it to so-and-so." They even put it on T-shirts, no less.
Boys, we'll get a look at some of our California girls here. Let's get a rating on this. King, if you'll stick it up here. Beach Boys, California Girl. Why did you like that?
Well, I've heard it before, and I like the words, and I like the rhythm, so I gave it a 90.
Thing by the Beatles called A Hard Day's Night. What did you think of it?
Well, it had a real good beat, and I think the kids would really enjoy it. I think it'll go pretty far.
All right, this is Billy Idol and Moni Moni.
Oh, it's just an oldie but a goodie.
Well, I gave it an 85. I like it. I like the beat.
Well, I gave it a 90, and I think it's just bop.
I gave it a 90. I felt it had a good beat also, and it was easy to dance to.
I thought it was real easy to dance to, and it had a good beat.
I thought it was Boss, says one of them. That's good stuff. From American Bandstand and the late Dick Clark, let's go to the phones. Gerald's with us on the line from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, Gerald.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yes, my name is Gerald. I'm a teacher in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up in the middle 60s, and I was around about, like, 4 years old. And I'm about the same age as Janet Jackson.
Uh-huh.
And we loved Dick Clark. I grew up in a mostly white community, and it was just great looking at Dick Clark. Like, whenever a black star was going to come on Dick Clark,
mm-hmm.
all the black kids would, like, huddle together and say, at such and such a time, Dinah Ross and the Supremes are going to come on. So everybody was running the house at that particular time like we was going to vote for the president or something, you know? Yeah, we loved it. And then our parents would look at Dick Clark on New Year's Eve. It was like this family gathering or something.
So kind of going back to what we were talking about before, Dick Clark had that appeal to both the teens, or in Gerald's case, even younger at the time, and to the parents, which was certainly important. Dot is also on the line with us from Plainfield, New Jersey. Hi, Dot.
Hey, John.
Welcome to Soundcheck. What's your memory?
Thank you. My memory of Van Stan was I grew up with Van Stan during the days when it was on black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And a girlfriend and I, Patty, we would both come home. We'd see each other at school. We grew up in the same neighborhood. We'd go home after school to our separate homes. We'd put American Bandstand on the TV, and we'd get on the phone and we'd talk. And we'd share different memories and different thoughts about the kids who were on there and who was wearing what and who was dancing with who.
So this was like the 1960s version of live tweeting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was wonderful.
So
we will miss him.
Very, very similar to what Gerald was just saying about, you know, all the kids would rush home to watch. So it really, Max, it was a kind of a communal experience.
We talk about sometimes TV being the electronic hearth, and I think this is a real case of it. And, of course, listen, my kids, when they watch, whether it's Idol or Glee, they're constantly IMing their friends and talking about this artist and that and how they're doing or what they like or don't like. And I think this was going on before on that archaic device, the telephone.
Yes.
You know, it's a, I really think there was something that was, as you said, John, so aptly, that was cross-generational about the appeal, as well as this thing of, you know, music brings people together, as corny as that sounds, but it's true, and that had a lot to do at the heart of it, the shared experience that Bandstand was for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. Around that experience.
All right. Now, again, Dick Clark hosted American Bandstand from 1956 to 1989, after which we mostly knew him from shows that he did not appear on. He did that Bloopers show. Of course, New Year's Rockin' Eve. And actually, there are some comments coming in on the webpage. So let's go into the control room. Joel Myers got some of them.
John, three comments I want to share with you about New Year's Rockin' Eve. Stuart from Manhattan wants to share a little perspective. Stuart writes, "Your younger listeners may not remember life before Dick Clark. TV Fair on December 31st used to be old folks like your grandparents dressed in tuxedos and ball gowns dancing to Guy Lombardo's big band music from the Waldorf Astoria." A listener who calls him or herself Falcon Harry writes, "The channel was not to be changed on New Year's Eve during Dick Clark's Rockin' Eve." And Richard from Bushwick writes, "I look forward to still seeing Dick Clark host the 2013 New Year."
Wouldn't put it past him.
No, I wouldn't either.
What happened to Bandstand? Why did it go off the air?
I think it had its run. I think there was kind of this conventional wisdom, especially with the rise of MTV, that had a lot to do with taking some of the power out of this weekly syndicated dance show.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting comment from a listener who describes his or herself as a B fan. "No mention yet of who wrote the theme to American Bandstand. None other than that famous jingle writer, you deserve a break today, Barry Manilow."
Wow. Now I'm learning something.
Yeah.
I should have known that.
So American Bandstand runs through 1989. It's a victim of the rise of MTV. The amazing thing about this guy, though, is that with all of the new media, he's still plugging along on good old broadcast TV and making a mint. All of these shows.
He certainly was. You know, the American Music Awards, Country Music Awards, he was involved with all that. And he just had a real knack for public taste. And he was unabashed about it. He said, "What I'm doing is not serious. This is about fun. This is entertainment. This is pure entertainment. This isn't about enlightening the public. This is commercial," mm-hmm. capital C commercial.
So he did the Bloopers show. He did the New Year's show. There was the Pyramid show, which I think I knew it as the $25,000 pyramid. Apparently it started at $10,000 and
yeah.
ended up like at $20 million or something.
Yeah, like everything else, it became a victim of inflation.
So there was a TV empire that he was masterminding. But for many of us, he will be remembered for American Bandstand and the New Year's Rockin' Eve. And Bob from Montclair, New Jersey, on the line with us. What do you remember Dick Clark for?
I remember and have to thank Mr. Clark for helping me learn how to dance things that I was afraid to do in front of other people, especially the gals that I was interested in.
Like
and
what
that,
dances?
You know, you could watch, well, it's even the twist, something mm-hmm. that simple.
Okay. And did you do the Watusi or the Pogo?
the thing about it was you could watch the show. You know, we didn't have ways of recording and playing things back
right.
like we do now. So we could watch the show, and the next day we could say, what did he do, and how did he do it again, and watch the thing again.
Uh-huh.
And that repetition was something that was not available any other way except on his show, and, you know, that's pretty much it. So I think there was a very compelling reason for a lot of us, you know, kids, especially the guys, to try and learn a step or two before we put ourselves out there.
Good point. Good point, Bob. Max, to kind of wrap this up, there is a return now to the TV dance party thing. According to our friend Chris Richards, the pop music critic at The Washington Post, there is, of all places, in Philadelphia, where Bandstand started, a show called Dancing on Air, which had an initial run in the 80s and is now back on the air. So, again, a kind of lingering echo of Dick Clark.
Oh, I think there will be always, in a sense. I think that it's music was at the heart of this, and pop music was at the heart of it. And as, you know, each generation comes into its own, they're going to want to make that connection. They're going to want to, I mean, and I think just the kind of the growth of social media and whatnot only enhances that. So if in the privacy of my own home, like the caller before, I can try out the latest dance craze, or it's going to be the first place I hear a great new pop song. Wow, that's terrific. And, you know, and tell my friends about it. There you go.
We've had lots of calls from New Jersey for some reason. Let's pick up the phone and talk to Anne from right here in Manhattan. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. Like one of your earlier callers, I was in junior high school, used to watch it every day and talk to my friends over the phone. But I think that what made Dick Clark and Bandstand really special is it was the first national show that made us teenagers feel like we mattered, like we were important. It was our thing. We talked about it in school the next day. And it was really the beginning of teenagers as a market.
Max, that's a really good point.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. It's so true that, and that was, again, Dick Clark, a guy who grew up in a radio family, was really shrewd about it at a time where a lot of people didn't realize teens mattered. That's where buying habits are shaped. That's where if you're trying to sell something, you have if you can get their attention, and it isn't easy to do, and it's still hard to do, boy, you can make some money. But I think you're right. I think it was very empowering, empowering to see kids like yourself and hear the music you wanted to hear on television.
And nowadays, with, you know, the teen audience being so in demand, and, you know, it's what every advertiser wants. They're like the target demographic for everything. It's hard to think that within our lifetimes there was a time where teens were just sort of like, who cares? Who cares what they want?
Things have changed so much, and Dick Clark was really prescient in realizing the power of teens and to really address what they wanted to see and what they wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm. All right. Our listener, Platypus Darren from Astoria, writes, what a multidextrous talent. Dick Clark could transition easily from radio to music, TV to game shows, and comedy blooper programs, all with class and politesse. Godspeed, and God bless Dick Clark. I think we'll leave it there. We've been speaking with Max Robbins from the Paley Center for Media and remembering the late Dick Clark. He died yesterday at the age of 82. Max, nice speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Sean, a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Mom and Dad are so proud of Uncle Bandstand. And I'll jump and hit, I may even show him my handstand. Because I'm on the American Bandstand. When we dance real slow, I'll show all.
Still to come, for people of a certain age, the American Bandstand music we've been playing has probably brought back a flood of memories. Music and memory is the focus of an amazing new documentary called Alive Inside, and we'll learn more about that next. This is Soundcheck.
Bandstand, Bandstand.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. As we've learned over and over on this program, the music that we listen to as teenagers stays with us throughout our lives. Now we know that it even stays with those who suffer from dementia, as shown in a new documentary being premiered this week in New York called Alive Inside. You might already have seen part of it. A clip featuring an Alzheimer's patient named Henry recently went viral and as of today has been viewed more than 6 million times on YouTube. The film follows social worker Dan Cohen and his music and memory project. Dan is here with me in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here, John.
So, in short, what does music and memory aim to do?
It aims to take advantage of the power of personalized music to reach people who may have some form of dementia, or who are depressed, or who are living either at home alone and isolated, or in a some sort of care facility, to improve their spirit and their lives.
Mm-hmm. And this film, Alive Inside, was made by Michael Rosato Bennett. He followed you around. As I understand it, it was just supposed to be like a quick little thing, and then he ended up following you for a year?
Yes, or more. Uh-huh.
And so you've been fighting for a long time to get kind of visibility, support to do this, to bring music to these elderly patients. Then suddenly a little clip of this movie goes viral.
Yes.
And you've got like 6 million people.
Yes.
In a little more than a week.
Yes.
Watching Henry. Tell me about Henry. Where did you find him, and what happened when you first brought music to him?
Okay. Well, I was working with the Cobble Hill Health Center in Brooklyn, and I say to them, well, let's find some individuals here who may have dementia, who could maybe agitated or isolated, and let's find out what their favorite music is and try that and see how that works. And with Henry, Henry's a gentleman who really may have had his head down sort of on in front of him on a little table in front, quiet, not saying much. But when we gave him his music, he just throw his arms in the air and starts singing the words to the song to almost perfect rhythm.
It's a startling transformation to watch during the course of the film, because Henry is, as you say, he's got his head, you know, he doesn't even lift his head up. He's just kind of slumped in his chair. His daughter comes to see him. He doesn't recognize her, doesn't really communicate. You put this headset on him, and you've got one of those little iPod shuffles.
That's correct.
How did you know what to play for him?
Well, we ask their family.
Okay.
So Henry's fortunate. He has loved ones who can provide us that information, and you know, what he liked when he was young, and you know, what he was singing in the house, and what they were listening to as a family.
So this is a little bit of the song that this Brooklyn nursing home resident Henry was listening to in his headphones in this viral video. The song is by Walter Hawkins and the Love Center Choir. That is Walter Hawkins, a veteran gospel group, with Going Up to Yonder. That's the name of the song that my guest Dan Cohen played for this nursing home resident named Henry.
Yes.
So you found out this is the kind of thing he likes, and then you put the headset on him, and do you press the button, you hit play, and what happens?
And then he starts enjoying the music. It goes to a part, even though much of the memory might be a short-term memory, is ravaged and dissipated. Long-term memories from your youth of the music you knew is pretty much preserved.
Mm-hmm.
So you can reach that despite whatever limitations cognitively you have. And so that really is sort of a path to someone's being and self and enjoyment.
And then remarkably, when he takes the headphones off, the filmmaker who's been following you around and making this movie, Michael Rosato Bennett, actually starts to interview Henry, who, having been unresponsive just a few minutes ago, is now able to answer questions. Listen to this.
Henry.
Yeah?
Do you like the iPod? Do you like the music you're hearing?
Yes.
Tell me about your music.
Well, I don't have one, I mean.
Do you like music?
Yeah, I'm crazy about music. You play beautiful music, beautiful sound.
Did you play music when you were, did you like music when you were young?
Yes, I went to big dances and things.
What was your favorite music when you were young?
Well, Cab Calloway was my number one band guy. I liked it.
What's your favorite Cab Calloway song?
Oh, I'll be home there for Christmas. Oh, you can count plans on me with plenty of snow.
That is just an amazing transformation that happens right there in front of the cameras for this documentary film, Alive Inside. You heard Michael Rosato Bennett. He's being told off camera, just ask him yes or no questions.
Yes.
But then when he departs from that and asks some like more complex questions, this is the response he gets. This man starts singing.
Yes.
This is part of the viral video that is online. You can watch it on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Now, Dan, is this a typical response or is this really unusual?
Well, what's so interesting, so we now have this operating in 50 nursing homes in 15 states and Canada, and every one of them will report that with their residents who have dementia, this is working. They say the impact, if somebody doesn't talk very much, they end up talking more. If someone's not physically active, they're moving around more. And if someone is depressed, they feel better. So this just, somehow it's working. And it's not just, this is not a one-off thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're speaking with Dan Cohen, social worker and executive director of the Music and Memory Project. And joining us here in the studios as well is Anne Wyatt. She's a residential care policy and strategy consultant for the New York City chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Anne, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So the idea of music therapy, not really totally new. I mean, we see Connie Tomaino in this film.
Oh, absolutely.
And she's been pioneering this for like 20 years or
yes,
more.
Yes, indeed.
How is Dan's project different?
Well, I think that what Dan brought to all of us is the notion that personalized music can be meaningful for somebody with dementia in a residential care setting and that it's really possible. It lightens everything up in the nursing home for the person with dementia and for the people around them, the caregivers, the family members, everyone mm-hmm. around them. It just changes things. And I think that I was very struck as I watched other people watching the film last night that I think many people don't believe it's possible for that level of comfort or pleasure to still be available to somebody who has that much dementia. And the movie and Dan's faith in it really has made that possible. It has the potential for changing people's expectations. It doesn't take away from the pain of dementia or the loss for family members, but it does manage to bring comfort in that moment, which is a huge thing to be able to have.
Mm-hmm. One of the people we see in the film is Dr. Oliver Sacks,
yes.
who explains that, you know, there is no music center in the brain. There's no one place that can be damaged and therefore lost. Music affects the brain throughout.
Yes.
So people who have Alzheimer's, dementia of one form or another, can still access that music.
Yes, and I think an important point with Henry as Louise, who is the director of recreation at Cobble Hill, where he resides, talks about the fact that when Henry goes to a regular music program, he'll sit there, you know, and kind of tap his fingers or his feet a little bit. He enjoys it. But it's when his own favorite music comes on that this transformation occurs. And I think that's a really important piece that Dan has really brought to us, is that it's the personalization of it that makes mm-hmm. the difference.
And how unusual is it in a communal setting like a nursing home or an advanced care facility to get that kind of individual attention?
It's very hard. I think it's two things. It's hard because, of course, there are a lot of people to care for and much to be done. But I think what Dan has brought to this is the notion that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's what really makes the difference.
Well, in this clip from the film Alive Inside, the documentary by Michael Rosato Bennett, where he follows Dan around for a year, we hear the voices of a Brooklyn nursing home administrator named Tony Lewis and Dr. Bill Thomas, a gerontologist, talking about this issue.
For the staff in a big system to be able to focus entirely on one single individual and identify what their needs are musically and to be able to work out and present and produce something that's unique to that individual really, to me, goes to the heart of person-centered care.
In today's system, I can sit down and write out a script for $1,000 a month antidepressant. No problem. Nobody asks any questions. If I want to provide a person with a $40 personal music system, that will take a lot of work.
And that, Dan Cohen, is exactly what you're trying to do, is to get people to buy these relatively inexpensive music systems for people at the, what is it, 3,000, 6,000? How many nursing homes are
actually
there?
Actually, 16,000.
16,000 in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's also a clip in the movie where you're talking to two separate administrators, and they're both, you know, pushing back. They're like, yeah, we really, you know, we can't do this. They do have concerns.
Absolutely.
Perhaps justifiable ones. I mean, how sort of repeatable is the Henry experience, the putting on the headphones, getting, you know, someone who's been unresponsive to suddenly be there and alert and in the moment?
It's very repeatable. I mean, right now we have it a best practice approach to doing this. So any nursing home, we know that, in fact, for the staff, it makes their job easier in a sense when someone's more cooperative and attentive and engaged. And the nursing home, you know, it's a morale lifter for the staff because it's a repeatable thing. And so you can apply this across many. There's nothing to lose and everything to gain, in other words, with the
right.
music.
So how do you respond to people who have concerns? I mean, how do you address them?
Well,
when you're trying?
The top concerns are the iPads are going to get lost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have a way to secure them and log them in and out. And the second concern is staff is really busy and they don't have time for something else. But what we're finding, and Luis also Dueño has learned, and they have over 80 iPods, that in fact, because residents are more cooperative, things get done more quickly. So therefore, staff isn't spending as much time doing the bathing and the dressing and the feeding. So it becomes more efficient also for the facility. And that, you know, administrators appreciate that.
The film Alive Inside, which is Michael Rosato Bennett's documentary about Dan Cohen's music and memory project, has a sold-out screening tomorrow at the Rubin Museum, but there will be three more screenings on Saturday at 11:30, 2:30, and 5:30. It's a remarkable film, and after each screening, there'll be a Q&A with neuroscience and Alzheimer's specialists. Anne Wyatt is here with me in the studio, Dan Cohen as well. And Soundcheck listeners, if you have a question or story about music and dementia, you can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. And Sylvie is on the line with us from Staten Island. Sylvie, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, it's Celia, actually. And
Celia, sorry about that.
Hi, that's all right. Thank you so much for having such a wonderful program. I wanted to comment that my mother was sick for about 16 years with advancing dementia of multiple kinds, and she was an opera singer and played piano and sang in many different languages. And even after she lost the ability to speak English, she could sit down at the piano and play and sing in several languages and really flawlessly.
Hmm.
So it would serve programs in nursing homes well to provide lessons and practice time for for patients who have had the ability to play and still want to express themselves musically, because that form of communication lasts really to the end
of the disease.
Right. Celia, just to let you know, that Anne's sitting here shaking her head vigorously up and down. So, Anne, you've had some experience with this?
Oh, yes. We've heard many stories of people who have who are musicians and who retain that ability and that connection long after many other connections have been lost. So it's good to have it confirmed.
But probably not a whole lot of places have access to pianos. And that's not as simple as a $40 iPod.
Well, right, although I would say probably most facilities have them, but it is really important to make the connection, to know the person that you have with you, and to help, to believe, first of all, that it's possible, and then to help it happen. Bring them to the piano. Spend some time with them.
Now, there's also a moment for me, one of the most startling moments in this documentary, Alive Inside, is when the filmmaker shows us a map of the world with some of the countries colored in. These are the countries where 20% or more of the population is over 65.
Yes.
And it's like Northern Europe and Japan. The next map is what your children's world will look like, and virtually all of the map has been colored in. You know, we are undergoing, whether we know it or not, realize it or not, a kind of real change in the demographics that we're living in. And it seems like, you know, part of what Dan is doing and what you're trying to do with, is to kind of prepare for the coming wave of people who are aging into this.
Very much so.
What about, Dan, the idea of, you know, these are people who did not grow up with technology. Is putting on headphones and, you know, having a little shiny disc in their hand, is it, you know, kind of unnerving?
That's a great question. Well, sure. The whole idea of this is to just take the whole technology question out of the picture. What music do you like? Here it is. So they're not, if they can't operate it, fine. They clip on the back and they have the headphones on and they're enjoying it. Sometimes they don't like the feel of the headphones, but so we can have a speaker next to them, you know, playing the music. But the headphones are best because it takes out all the ambient noise, especially in a nursing home. You may be sharing a room. There's stuff going on, and so that allows a real pristine, you know, depth of music experience.
Now, one of the women that you meet during the course of the film is Mary Lou.
Yes.
Mary Lou has early onset Alzheimer's.
I know she was diagnosed 4 years before that screening or that filming.
Mm-hmm. You know? And when we first see her, she is disoriented, obviously confused. But she's just put on your iPod, and it's playing one of her favorite songs, the Beach Boys' I Get Around.
That's the best thing I've ever had, this thing. I don't know how to say it. It's just, it can't get away from me if I'm in this place.
Yeah. I thought you were going to grow wings.
I was trying.
That is Mary Lou talking to the filmmaker, Michael Rosato Bennett, who has made this documentary, Alive Inside, about Dan Cohen's Music and Memory Project. And then, Dan, we see you sitting down with Mary Lou, kind of playing her little snippets of songs. You're making a playlist.
I'm just making a playlist, you know, because she can't name the tunes, but she can listen and tell me, yeah, no. You know, so we go through each one, and she's sort of thumbs up, thumbs down.
And it's like, name that tune. I mean, yeah. Hey Jude, yeah. You know, Hey Jude. And she knows what it is.
I guess that's
simple because the title's right there. But, I mean, literally, like, you don't get past a bar of the music before she's,
no.
Oh, yeah, that one. I know that one.
She's right there with the music. Yeah.
Let's take another call. Katie, on the line with us from New Jersey. Katie, I understand you actually worked in a nursing home. Is that right?
Yes, in our teenage years, my brother and I, my mother was a charge nurse in the nursing home, and it was kind of interesting because on Saturdays and Sundays, they would have programs for various generational music. Of course, in the 60s, you were going back to music from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, that type of thing. And my mother was always so excited because, as the nurse or the head nurse there, because so many people, their whole attitude, their interest in life that day and everything would just be so much more exciting or vital and energetic. And she was like, I wish we could do this every day. So it's kind of nice to hear that someone's really picked up on this. I'm really excited about it.
And if we did have that sort of anecdotal evidence as far back as the 60s. Why has it taken so long for this kind of realization to sink in?
Well, I think music has always been popular in long-term care facilities for the obvious reason that you can have a musician come and have a large room full of people, and, you know, that always works. I think that it's technology that has made it really brought the possibility of the depth of individualization.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what's made a big difference here. And, of course, we've learned more about it, too. I mean, bridging that gap to the notion that a personalized playlist, if you will, can return someone to themselves so deeply is more recent information.
Right. Let me give the last word on this subject to Gladys, who is calling in from Weehawken, New Jersey. Gladys, does anything about this conversation surprise you?
None at all. I mean, the problem is, as I said to the screener, that most Americans isolate themselves from older people the minute they begin to not be as youthful as they would want them to be. Everybody gets old and everybody dies. I had my parents living with us for 14 years. They were fine, and I saw the gradual beginning of dementia from my father. He, at the end of his life, he thought I was his mother or his daughter or his sister or his wife. It didn't matter, but the point is that it's important for people who are at that age not to be shoved into a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
Because my children are grateful to me eternally for having been around their grandparents.
Well, and
my father would sing songs. He would leave. They had a special apartment upstairs in our house. He would escape, come to our kitchen, appear, and start reciting a poem. And if he got it wrong, he'd start over. And that's when he was fighting. He was trying to remember.
Right. Well, I think that is one of the points of the documentary is that, you know, these individualized music programs really can bring the person out.
Yes.
who otherwise, Dan, would have a difficult time doing that. Well, first of all, thank you for joining us, and best of luck with the Music and Memory Project.
Thank you so much.
Dan Cohen is the subject of the film Alive Inside. Three more screenings on Saturday at the Rubin Museum. Ann Wyatt, also with us, residential care policy and strategy consultant for the New York chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Ann, thank you for being with us
You.
Singer Glenn Campbell announced last year that he has Alzheimer's. The 75-year-old performed at this year's Grammy Awards and received a Lifetime Achievement Award. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, Joe Strummer is the subject of a new book and documentary called Let Fury Have the Hour by Antonino D'Ambrosio. Antonino joins us to talk about the socially conscious punk rocker. And flamenco guitarist Pedro Soler teams up with his son, the avant-garde cellist Gaspar Claus, for a live performance. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck.